Paracelsus observed almost 500 years ago that learning should always be an arduous and uncomfortable procedure. So we recommend this evening as an indication of great dedication to something, particularly to the weather. Cheer up, when we get our new place, we'll have nice, cool places for everyone. And it looks a little nearer. I had some good reports today. This evening, we are beginning a series of five discussions on the philosophy of Paracelsus, especially as this relates to his principal concern in life, the treatment of disease. First of all, certain orientation, I think, is appropriate. The entire story of Paracelsus is part of the tremendous transition period which we know as having followed closely upon the Renaissance and the Reformation. Harrison, a great authority on the history of medicine, says that in this period, the great moving spirits were Luther in theology, Vesalius in anatomy, Paray in surgery, and Paracelsus in therapy. This gives us perhaps as good a summary as we can have. To begin with, then, this man, who had really a rather formidable name, Philippus Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim. No one cared to worry about it, so they finally decided to call him Paracelsus. Actually, the name Paracelsus means greater than Celsus. And whether this modest man bestowed it upon himself, or whether, as some suspect, his father bestowed it upon him, as a result of his early precocity in medicine, we probably will never know. He was a remarkable man in many respects. He studied medicine with his father, who was a physician and surgeon, associated with the order of the Teutonic Knights. His mother had a very remarkable position in society for her time. She was the superintendent of a hospital. And women were not generally superintendents of hospitals in 1490. Paracelsus was born the year before Columbus discovered America, born in 1491. And his brief and troublous life terminated about his 51st year. The exact reason and cause for his death is also unknown. His enemies declare that he died of drunken brawl. His friend said that he was pushed off a cliff by hired assassins of the medical fraternity. You can have your choice. From the feeling of the time, the assassination theory would have been well in the spirit of the attitude which organized science held regarding him. Paracelsus was one of those persons who could not fit in. He was a complete and rugged individual. From his early life, he declined completely to conform with any traditional procedure. He was hopelessly disillusioned with the medical faculty at the University of Basel, although he later returned and lectured there. He declared in public that the soft down on the back of his neck knew more about the practice of medicine than the entire faculty of the University of Basel. Obviously, this would have endeared him to his scientific contemporaries. His life tells us one very interesting story. He was one of the most complete empirics that we know in learning. Practically everything that he learned personally, by experience. And his conclusions and opinions were based upon the things that had personally happened to himself. In a day which was largely dominated by traditional forms and by a profoundly traditional scientific structure built upon the writings of Galen and Avicenna, Paracelsus departed from practically every recognized landmark. In early life, he followed medicine, even as a very young man, engaging in various medical activities with his parents. Later, he became deeply interested in religion, and learning of the researches of the celebrated abbot, Trithyme, abbot of Sponheim, he went there and studied with him for a number of years. This learned abbot was dedicated to alchemy, not merely the materialistic transmutation of metals, but the secret of the spirit of elements. With the abbot of Sponheim, he not only gained a profound knowledge of chemistry, but he also gained a deep understanding of scripture. The abbot was a man of tremendous intellectual capacity. And as a result of his long association with this learned man, Paracelsus is said to have reached a condition in which he could quote any verse of the Old or New Testament upon request. He had memorized the entire Bible. Now this had its practical value. At one period in his career, encouraged his scientific researches, he became a Bible salesman, wandered about Europe selling Bibles to make a living. He was not interested primarily in selling Bibles. He was interested primarily in wandering all over Europe, studying, meeting people, working with every class of human being that he could contact. He spent months with gypsies. He visited the old widow women that lived in their little cottages at the edge of town and dried their herbs, temples. He cultivated midwives. He learned everything that he could of the primitive beliefs of people, of the simple medical recipes and formulas that had been handed down in areas where no physician had ever practiced. And this, he established a precedent that was to survive even till now. For the last 2 or 3 years, we have sent medical expeditions to the most remote parts of primitive countries to investigate their remedial practices, and are discovering that most of these practices are founded upon well-established experimental basis. A little later, Paracelsus turned to another activity. He went out as a kind of physician and general superintendent into the mining districts of the Pyrrhus. Here for many years, he spent much of his time underground, working with the miners, studying the origin of metals, developing his knowledge of metallurgy, mining. And through his association with the great mining families of Thugus, he increased his knowledge on many other subjects. Later he went to the Netherlands and was made army surgeon, going with the army into war. As army surgeon, his principal problem was to amputate arms and legs. He did this in the traditional manner of the time, cauterizing with a red-hot iron. Anesthesia, things of this kind, totally unknown. After nearly 20 years of wandering, he began to organize his findings. And he added to many, many other accomplishments a line of basic thinking, which was later to distinguish him and to be associated with his name wherever it is mentioned on a philosophical level. Namely, he became a devout student of Neoplatonism. He followed largely in the footsteps of Pythagoras of Samos and of Plato of Athens. He was also deeply interested in the Neoplatonic philosophy of Plotinus, Proclus, and the so-called legitimate descendants of the great Platonic school. Descendants that branched off from Xenophon, the nephew of Plato. As a Neoplatonist, Paracelsus developed the great framework of the philosophy which he was later to develop, or to perfect, perhaps as no other physician ever achieved such perfection. We do not know today clearly what Paracelsus contributed to the pharmacopoeia or to the general knowledge of medicine. We know that he experimented very heavily with the mercury, that he was among the first to develop health methods, natural methods for the correction of disease. In fact, he was persecuted bitterly. They tried to collect the bill because he had not given the patient elaborate drugs. He had told the patient to take a bath, keep warm, watch his diet, and then sent the bill. The patient recovered but refused to pay because he hadn't received what the medical profession at that time would regard as an elegant treatment. He was too simple, too caustic, too sharp in his way and thinking. These were all points held strongly against him. The writings of Paracelsus, like his public lectures, were given in Swiss German, in a kind of low German, which he insisted, however, was not nearly as low as the Latin of that particular period. That is a time in which, without any use of profanity or a nasty word, we had what was called formally, classically, and in the dictionary, bastard Latin. It was a corruption beyond human conception. And several of the early editions of the Bible published in it were so bad that the original editors couldn't read the text. Paracelsus also pointed out that by mumbling Latin in a learned way, you can conceal a vast amount of ignorance. And he also took it for granted that every person, man, woman, and child, from the peasants to the prince, was entitled to understand the principles of therapy. Therefore, you should teach, not in the language of a chosen few, but in the argo of the people, so that the average listener could gain principles by which he could guard his own health or help to restore it if it had been afflicted. Paracelsus also pointed out that at his time, most of the remedies recommended were far too strenuous, that the patient not only had to recover from the ailment, but from the medication. And he advised the physician to keep the medications at a minimum so that the patient would have a chance of recovering from them. This also endeared him to everyone on a scientific level. Paracelsus has left a voluminous body of material of a literary form. We say literary with a certain amount of reservation, because while it is vastly important, it's by far no means a gem of writing. In the spirit of the times, it runs into thousands of folio pages with great deal of repetition and tremendous linguistic involvement. At the same time, we cannot afford to discredit or disregard the author on this ground. As far as we know, he wrote nothing himself, but used his amanuensis, a man by the name of Oswald Krolau, who did most of the actual writing for him. He apparently dictated it, or Krolau gathered it from notes. The greater part of the Paracelsian corpus, or body of writing, has not been translated into English. Certain sections with general appeal to special groups will be found available, but with one or two popular exceptions, even the English editions of his writings are rare. Perhaps the most available is the summary of his alchemical traditional writings and alchemical formulas and recipes, which were published as the Alchemetic and Hermetic writings of Paracelsus, translated into English with an introduction, a note by author Edward Waite. And the most handy available work on the general philosophy of Paracelsus is the work of Franz Hartmann, which is a summary of his doctrines planted rather strongly in the direction of theosophy. Stillman's Life of Paracelsus contains extracts from his work also. And there have been one or two recent works which are essentially digests, selecting here and there what may be regarded as choice fragments, at least in the mind of the editor. There are early translations in the 17th and a few in the 16th century, but these are almost as difficult to obtain as the originals. The work on the sympathetic medicine is available, done in an early 17th century edition, but no later printing. Therefore, we may say that probably three-quarters of the writings of Paracelsus are not generally available in English today, and are only accessible in manuscript copies from students or specialists in the field. Thus, we are not well equipped to examine his medical formulas or his general knowledge. That he possessed unusual knowledge, we know. The reports of his cures are almost fantastic. He early developed a remedy for tuberculosis that apparently was comparatively infallible. He also succeeded in curing diabetes at a time when this was considered an incurable ailment. After his death, his body was placed in St. Sebastian's Church in a small German town. Here it remained for some time. Later, a monument was placed over the remains, and the sick made pilgrimage to it for centuries, almost as they might have made pilgrimage to the Shrine of Lourdes. And prayers at the tomb of Paracelsus are reported on two occasions as having prevented the plague from taking its community. What the truth is, of course, we do not know. But certainly his name was greatly admired and honored in the field of medicine. Now, a person with his type of mind would naturally do what Paracelsus did. Instead of attempting to separate medicine and therapy in general from the total body of knowledge, he sought to restore it to the total body of knowledge. To him, to paraphrase a more recent comment, the undevout physician was mad. To Paracelsus, religion was an essential part of medicine, not only of therapy, but even of the inspiration or mystical overtone of prayer or meditation or mystical intuitive apperception, which he considered to be invaluable in the diagnosis of disease. He next built his entire concept upon a concept of the universe. Man was part of a total pattern of life. Here he is moving toward his Neoplatonic position. Man is not a separate creature, according to Paracelsus. And into the construction of man, the basic structure of the human being, the Adam primus of the Paracelsian viewpoint, the first Adam, or man, into his composition was incorporated everything which exists in the universe. Today we might scientifically point out that most elements have been discovered in the human body. But man is actually composed in miniature of nearly every element, substance, and material in nature. And that therefore man is bound to nature by immense bonds of sympathy. And in another lecture of this series, we will study the sympathetic medicine, or the sympathetic concept of Paracelsus, of a universe bound together as one living organism. Under this concept, sickness was man's departure from pattern. It was man breaking away or separating himself or some part of himself from the orderly motion of the world. As long as the individual remained in harmony with the total cosmic quiet in which he existed, he would be well. But the moment man attempted to separate himself, he was like a branch cut from a tree, destined to wither and die because he had separated his own personal existence from the great stream of universal life. Thus, the restoration of health was the restoration of universal motion in man, the reintegration of the individual into the universal harmony and order. And from that springs the series of philosophical speculations which constitute our first discussion this evening on the problem of natural and unnatural religion and philosophy. Now, in the use of natural and unnatural, Paracelsus is giving us a statement which is essentially based upon the early Greek philosophy. Namely, that there is a nature according to seeming, and a nature according to being. Everywhere there are things as they appear, and then there are things as they are. Now, in the Paracelsian concept, it is man himself who has interpreted away from things as they are. Man refuses dramatically, continually, to be simple. He must look for difficult things, difficult explanations, complicated and confused methods. And in so doing, he departs from things as they are and becomes hopelessly involved in a collection of personal speculations. These speculations, continuing on through the ages, become tradition. From tradition, learning accumulates. From learning, science is distilled, and philosophy, and even theology. Therefore, man lives in a world of traditional knowledge, created by his own kind, and passed on as a heritage from generation to generation. At the same time, man lives in a world of things as they are. And it is his inability to recognize things as they are which causes him to become enmeshed in the confusion of things as they seem to be. Thus, the beginning of the Paracelsian concept of therapy was that all problems in nature are essentially natural. Nature, for example, is an orderly creature, unfolding according to laws, maintaining patterns, proceeding in the sequences of absolute expectancy. Nature is seldom eccentric, seldom departs from its own rules, as far as we are able to observe. And although we now talk rather glibly of a-causal factors, Paracelsus believes that there is no need for this. That nature does not operate by miracle, nor can man. And he gives us his definition, that a miracle is an effect, the cause of which is unknown. But that cause must be equal in every respect to the effect which it produces. Therefore, behind all healing is an absolute pattern of cause and effect. Disease is a cause producing an effect. The various effects of disease are in turn causes for further effects, leading perhaps to the ultimate dissolution of the body. To recognize an absolute pattern of universal principles, to obey these principles, to compound medicines according to them, to administer these medicines according to natural laws, realizing that even in the giving of drugs, there are seasons and times for all things, that medications given at different times may have different effects. The researches which he carried on, therefore, took him into the most obscure fields of knowledge. He spent some time in Constantinople, studying with Arabic doctors, and declared on returning to Europe that here, among the Arabs, he at last discovered men of scientific stature. He found men, for example, to use his own thinking, who reasoned toward effects rather than from them, and reasoned toward conclusions instead of from them. In other words, he found among the Arabs what he termed the scientific attitude of natural inquiry. The physician as a child of nature, observing with admiration and surprise the wondrous workings of natural law. The Arabs seemed to be delighted to make a discovery. The European physician was afraid to make one, because one discovery might topple over the entire structure of his learning. The Arab, having no traditional form, was free to take new ideas. He was not confused because science might conflict with philosophy. He was not afraid that his therapy would bring him to the Inquisition or the rack. He did not have to worry about speculations concerning nature differing from the infallible axiomata of Aquinas or one of the great church fathers. The open mind to Paracelsus was best cultivated on the open road, to go to where knowledge was, to sit humbly in the presence of it, not to care where it came from in the sense of a level, to listen to the humble peasant as rapidly as the most learned physician, realizing always that nature's oracles are everything. And that man who would study the great book of nature, writes Theophrastus, must travel the pages with his feet. This wise search for knowledge placed Paracelsus perhaps at the top of the list of earnest and sincere men, not afraid to change his entire philosophy the moment he found a truth it conflicted with his own opinion. Whereas in Europe, the physicians were changing truths to conform with their opinion and were afraid to think. In the times of the great Hohenheim, a surgeon seldom, if ever, performed an operation, particularly if he was a learned man. He would sit on a large chair with a gold-tipped wand in his hand and a full medical regalia, ermine, trim, coat, and everything, and allow his apprentices to perform the surgery. And one of the earliest Caesarean sections in Europe was performed by a hog gelder. Bleeding was done principally by barbers. And the traditional red and white striped barber pole is the ancient symbol of the bleeding bandage. Barbers took care of surgery, midwives took care of obstetrics, witches took care of the poor, and the sorcerers took care of the rich. There was practically no ordinary available pattern of health. Health was comparatively unknown. An edict was published shortly before the time of Paracelsus warning the people of Europe that to take more than one bath a year was to endanger health. Another edict was that you must sleep with every window of the house closed to keep the plague out. Plague doctors went around dressed like Ku Klux Klansmen with bundles of herbs on sticks hanging in front of their noses. It was an incredible situation. And into it came this incredible man who advocated the tearing up of all the paraphernalia, the discarding all of the traditional forms. He publicly burned the texts of Galen and Avicenna in a brazier in front of the college door and told the people and the physicians that the only way that they would ever find out what they wanted to know was to go out themselves, work with the sick, sit with them, stay with them, experiment with various remedies of a new or different kind, search for the solutions to things that have not been found, rather than merely to perpetuate forever the old formula. His Advent was therefore rather premature. Had he lived 200 years later, he probably would have been more welcome, if perhaps less necessary. But in his own day, he was a vital, dynamic factor. So we come to the Neoplatonic foundation to determine, if possible, what is the difference between natural religion and unnatural religion. According to Paracelsus, natural religion is the kind which we see around us and which is sustained forever by the evidences of law, order, beauty, rhythm, harmony, integration, everywhere obvious in the world. Natural religion has nothing to do with theology. Theology should be its handmaiden. Theology should take natural religion and press the search for the truth of it. The moment a dogma is introduced, natural theology dies. Because a dogma is a limitation, a restriction, an imposing upon the mind of that which may and will most likely limit the mind and close it to the observation of natural facts. Thus, we do not need any dogmatic factor, as Paracelsus points out, to love God, to venerate truth, to serve the good, to do all things possible, to keep the golden rule and the Ten Commandments. These things arise not from man, but in nature. The moment, however, we depart into speculation, we begin to restrict observation. We gradually substitute a kind of chemistry performed in the mind for the direct observation of the facts themselves. And as we do this, we inevitably depart from facts. And most of all, we depart from the great moral overtones of facts. We depart from the tremendous, rich message of religion that facts themselves would sustain. As Lord Bacon observed, it is not necessary that God performs miracles inasmuch as the natural works of deity are more miraculous than any miracle we can conceive. Thus, the proof of deity lies not in miracle, but in nature, in the complete and total observation and reflection upon the thing as it is, the fact. Paracelsus became quite a psychologist and was one of the founding spirits in this field of research. He advocated constantly that the relationship be recognized between attitude and disease. He developed a philosophy based also upon Greek and other early sources on elementaries. Elementaries are imaginary or unreal beings generated by the attitudes of human beings. Elementaries are therefore thought forms. We might call them complexes or phobias. They are creatures that have no life except the life that man imposes upon them or bestows to them. Yet man can nourish them and sustain them so that they become parasite-like creatures, attacking him, attaching themselves to him, and finally destroying him. Paracelsus pointed out that every unreasonable or irrational attitude of a human being, every destructive mood, every negative emotion, could and would produce psychic parasites that would drain his natural resources and gradually destroy his mentality. To Paracelsus, apparently, these parasites were beings, false beings, homunculi, creatures created by man. Today, we regard them not as living, but as thought forms, or as complexes and phobias or fixations or frustrations, but perhaps we may sometime find that he was right. It may well be that vitalized by man's own vital, emotional, mental energy, these creatures do assume parasitic proportions, attaching themselves to the mental, emotional structure and gradually vampirizing it, destroying it. In any event, he was already working with this equation, the definite belief that the human attitude could result in the ultimate destruction of the body of man. It could result in the breaking away of the individual from the tree of life. Now, we have already mentioned the analogy of the branch separated from the tree. Man departing from virtue, integrity, honor, intelligence, common sense, any of these factors separates himself or breaks away from the common life of his kind. The moment the man declares war upon anything, he declares war upon his own life. The moment he segregates himself, the moment he takes the attitude of the Pharisee, that he is holier than someone else, what he factually does is to separate himself from the common stream of life. Paracelsus believed in the uncommon person, that is true. But he believed also that we are all essentially bound to nature, and that we have a community in nature. And that in this sense, commonness is survival. What we share in common is our strength. And those things in which we are alone is our danger. Now man, as far as he is right, can never be alone. As far as he is wrong, he can never share with nature. Therefore, rightness is community existence. In harmony with natural order and natural law. On the level of philosophy, we have the same problem, natural and unnatural philosophy. Natural philosophy is that which appears sometimes as the strange intelligence of the so-called unlearned. Paracelsus had a profound respect for the unlearned. He did not believe that the individual who was lacking in academic training was necessarily uninformed. In many ways, he believed that the person who had been spared from the corrupting influence of the curriculum was more likely to be intelligent. He was therefore deeply perturbed with this matter of what is intelligence. And he found intelligence in the dog, who, having a sickness in itself, went out into the forest, found certain grasses, ate them, and got well. Now, this dog did not have a physician. This dog had not been trained. This dog was depending upon instinct. And Paracelsus declares that instinct is a kind of sympathetic association between the separate creature and the total existence. That the individual who achieves to a high degree of wisdom restores his instinct. That we call instinct that has been purified, redeemed, and finally perfected and released intuition. And what to the animal is instinct, to man is intuition. Instinct is natural. Intuition, to a degree, has to be acquired. But it is not an acquired knowledge. It is an acquired sensitivity to fact. And in the educated person, it generally results from disillusionment, in which, through a long and difficult intellectual journey, the individual has come at the end like Faust, who states that here he stands with all his lore, a fool no wiser than before. And having reached this recognition of his own folly,
He becomes receptive. Paracelsus was very strongly of the opinion that man was never going to be able to battle his way to security at the expense of nature. His way was not of the conqueror. He could not force nature's secrets from her. If he tried to, he would receive only certain fragments, and these fragments could be deadly. And wherever man ravishes nature, he ultimately destroys himself. On the other hand, the natural person, the simple person, following obedience, depending entirely upon an intuitive or instinctual apperception of value, discovers in nature an ever-present guide. That when man relaxes and becomes quiet, nature speaks. And it is the voice of nature and not the voice of man that is the authority. Man must therefore explore, as Paracelsus says, the three worlds or the three spheres in which he will find the key. He tells us that deity or universal power has given man three keys or three sources of information. The first, as would be expected in the time of the Reformation, was Holy Writ. The second, nature. And the third, the human body. These are the three great textbooks. And the individual who can unite these gains the power of knowledge, true knowledge. He gains the capacity, and he must possess with this capacity, first of all, religious insight. Now, natural religious insight, according to Paracelsus, began and was established in the simple acceptance of the divine will as it is manifested in the divine work. Man, therefore, must have within him the capacity to take a simple attitude of veneration toward life. He must venerate the heavens and the earth. He must venerate the life in the trees and in the ocean. He must venerate the earth beneath his feet, the sunset and the clouds. He must venerate the body of the sick man with whom he is working. He must recognize the medication as worthless except for the divine power within it. He must realize that man heals nothing, but that God in man and nature doeth the work. That diagnosis is not merely from traditional learning, but from sympathy. That through great love and great understanding of the need of the suffering sick, we reach a more or less sacred mood or attitude in which prayerfully we request, and in prayer we are answered. Thus, to Paracelsus, the whole practice of medicine began in the study of the universe, the tremendous harmonies and patterns which it contains, and the ability of the individual to observe, to seek for himself, to find no source too humble, no idea too strange, to be given proper consideration. To the original or basic instinct must also be added the next, namely experimentation. No remedy is proven merely because it exists. It is proven only because through labor, through industry, through patient observation, it is checked and rechecked. Paracelsus was also one of the first to point out the importance of under-medication on the ground that it is possible gradually to increase the dosage if necessary, but that to begin with too great a dosage may do the greater ill. Therefore, in all his remedies, he approached the subject with extreme caution. recognizing that the capacity of bodies to take certain medications differed with each individual, and that what might cure one might be destructive to another. There should be a reason for this. It must be known and understood. And early in his researches, Paracelsus came upon a premise which undoubtedly has been fulfilled in the vitamin theory. He recognized the basis of all energy as being energy units, and that these energy units constituted the nutritional factor in food and air and all of the essentials necessary to human life. Man did not live upon the carcasses of the dead. He gained no actual strength from the potato or the steak. These are not the source of nutrition, but they carry within them a nutritional unit. And it is this energy upon which the body must depend. And it is not that the food, but the sympathetic energy bound to it, becomes the basis of nutrition. The same is true also of medication. It is not the mineral medicine which accomplishes a cure, but the magnetic field of that medicine, which establishing a polarization within the body, attracts energy. So Paracelsus recognized a universe of natural energy. He recognized reasons or causes why this energy could be cut off from the body. He recognized the moment the body was separated from its energy supply, the body was no longer able to function. Therefore, by obstruction, or the interference with natural processes, the situation was established which led to disintegration, corruption, decay, infection, and things of that nature. So we began by taking theology and philosophy and interpreting them in terms of natural science, deriving all of his scientific principles from the basic concepts of universal harmony and order. We are not surprised, therefore, to observe that he involved himself in a number of strange theories, theories which he had to examine. He also made a great number of discoveries which he was not able to explain. Later, one of the Paracelsian physicians, Dr. Kenelm Digby, in England, developed what he called a weapon saw. When a man was injured with a sharp weapon, the medication was placed upon the weapon instead of the wound, and the patient recovered. Now, this seemed to be an incredible and impossible situation. Paracelsus said, no. There is a principle here somewhere. And through numerous experiments of this kind, he carried on his investigations of what he termed the sympathies in nature. Another interesting discovery that he made was that in certain parts of Germany, he observed the skins of animals that had been tacked up on the wall to cure or to dry after the animal had been killed. He went back day after day and found that the fur on the animal's skin continued to grow after the animal was dead. He observed also that certain stuffed birds in a museum in Germany continued to grow feathers, although the bird had been in a case and dead for years. No one had noticed it, but he did. And he began to say, why is this true? He then made examinations of the bodies of the dead and found that beards grew after the body was dead. He began to study these things. There must be laws. There must be principles. there must be a source of energy available, and furthermore, things like the fur of animals, bird feathers, and human beards and hair must be separate living organisms capable of a degree of survival apart from the common body to which they were associated. From this theory, Paracelsus began to develop a support for his concept that all bodies in nature are compounds. That what we call a body is not one living organism, but is a multitude of organisms brought together under the sovereignty of a human will or a human consciousness. He found in this strong support for the older belief of the macrocosm-microcosm theory, namely that the universe was the great being and man was the little universe. That man himself was a cosmic system, that he had within his own nature miniature polarity for everything that existed outside of him and around him in the universe. Paracelsus was not much given to dissection. Perhaps he was too much of a Pythagorean, for the members of this school did not like the concept of the disfiguring of the body after death. But he was in the presence of physicians who were. And Paracelsus came to the conclusion that man was a complete functioning miniature of the cosmos. That therefore, each of these units could be interpreted in terms of the other. Each was a key to the other. If we could understand the world, we would understand man. If we could truly understand man, we would understand the world. Now, Paracelsus early observed that in viewing both the world and man, we view only surfaces. All we know of the cosmos is that which is revealed to us through some degree quality of observation, whether it be with the unaided eye or with the most powerful telescope or spectroscope. Everything that we know is through observation. Observation of surfaces. Our faculty perception cannot observe depth. And that which is beyond the grasp of the five senses cannot be observed. And as practically every important fact is beyond the five senses, man is limited by his faculties to a universe of trivia. He is limited to observe things in which the solutions or the causes are not visible, not apparent, and not available. Now, in the case of the universe, there are two ways of approaching it. One is scientific, the other is theological. Theological approach is entirely introspective or contemplative, mystical. Scientific is entirely observational, physical, objective. Between these two, there must be a coordinating link. This middle ground is taken by philosophy. Philosophy is forever trying to support the unseen by the evidence of the seen, and is forever attempting to demonstrate the presence of the unseen in the seen. In other words, philosophy attempts a rational explanation of the causes behind effects, or of the causes in themselves in relation to chains of effects which may be dependent upon them. Thus, philosophy is the great reconciler of the seen and the unseen, giving man confidence in the invisible from the visible, making it reasonable to him that things seen are related to causes unseen. The causes in substance are theological, the effects are scientific, and the rationalization process of uniting them is philosophical. If, therefore, all of these analogies can be sustained, man then becomes a useful key to the study of all things other than man. And the study of all things other than man becomes valuable because it becomes a key to man. Thus, all knowledge of universals gives us skill in particulars, and all contemplation of particulars gives us an intuitive recognition of universals or generalities. Thus, Paracelsus attempted to reconcile the Platonic and Aristotelian approaches to knowledge. Now, having this thought basically established, that we have here natural science, natural philosophy, natural theology, we, according to Paracelsus, would say that natural theology is perhaps most completely revealed through the human body. And that in the functions of man, we have available to us a miniature world, near enough, understandable enough for us to comprehend. In order to study the mysteries of space, we do not need to go out there, because there is no quality of space in space that is not in man. Everything we search outside of him is in him. And everything we find within him has its parallel, correspondent, or equivalent outside of him. Thus, in a comparatively moderate form, we have not only the available textbook of man, suitable for the understanding of nature, but also suitable for the perfection of philosophy and religion. While in Constantinople, it is quite probable that Paracelsus was in contact with the dervishes and other Eastern sects. It is quite possible that through them he was introduced to a concept which is prevalent throughout Asia, and which, of course, does underlie the Christian scriptures, although not so obviously. If you study almost any system of cosmogony in connection with the sacred writings of Eastern peoples, you will find that they are all based upon embryology, that the universe is always considered as a great body. In the Vedas and in the great Indic writings, the universe is said to be born from the womb of Meru, or space. And the entire creation is formed and developed according to the principle of generation. Thus, we know that ancient peoples, in the integration of their great concepts on scientific, philosophical, and religious levels, were primarily influenced by observation.